to at least approve and what have you. But don't forget that we've got our Faith Promise Missions Conference coming up next week. All right, so not tomorrow night, but the following Thursday, we start our Missions Conference. It's like right on us. All right, so be much in prayer about that. Be praying about, you know, be praying for our missionaries that'll be here. Be praying about what God might lead you to contribute to the Faith Promise so that we can do more or at least keep up with the mission work that we're doing. Because here in the last couple of months, our missions offering has really declined. In fact, we were just making a comment today, this past week is the lowest one I ever remember, ever. And so, you know, it could have just hit that way, but it's just something that we need to be in prayer about because we want to make sure that we're able to meet our obligations, and it would be really good to be able to pick up the missionaries that will be with us this year, as well as, you know, the possibility of helping some church starts this year as well that we know are kind of on the horizon. So be much in prayer for that. Also, let me announce, I will not be available this Saturday for visitation. So for those of you that had intentions of coming out Saturday morning for our door-to-door visitation, we will not be going out. Now, you're welcome to go out. If you'd like to go out, see Miss D, all right, because D will be going out, all right? And I'm sure she would love to have you go out with her, but I will not have a crew going out, okay? So I apologize for that. I have other obligations this particular Saturday. I guess those are the only real announcements I have. All right. So turn, if you would, to 2 Kings chapter 10. I want to start with actually something I wanted to mention back when we were in chapter 35. And I ran out of time to mention this, and I thought, well, I'll just wait till the following week. And I totally forgot about it last week. And so I want to go ahead and hit it. But this takes us all the way back to chapter 35. And the reason I do that is because if you remember, in chapter 35, Jacob had come to Bethel and had brought everybody to Bethel to where he could make, you know, promises to God, and where God renewed the promises to him that he had made to Abraham and to Isaac and then unto Jacob. And so Bethel was in a really important place for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It was an incredibly important place for them. And each of them, you know, had an opportunity to name it. Well, Abraham and Jacob had an opportunity to name it, you know, and they did that. And Jacob even took it a step farther and called it El Bethel, which means God of the house of God, you know. So he took it just to that next level, that next step. And so Bethel is an incredibly important place. And it was a spiritual place. It was a place of spiritual renewal for Abraham, a place of spiritual renewal on two occasions for Jacob. It was just some place that was really special for the Israelites. Now, I say all of that to bring you to 2 Kings chapter 10. Because although Bethel was such a place of spiritual renewal and how God, you know, used that to really establish the hearts of Abraham and of Jacob, and it was such a special place in that regard, what we find is that Israel, later northern Israel, winds up turning it into a place of false worship. And they had actually built one of the calves there that represented Baal, and it became a place of Baal worship. In fact, when you get into the minor prophets, a couple of them, Hosea being one of them, a couple of them were instructed of God to instruct Israel to no longer have anything to do with Bethel. Don't go back. Bethel is a place they was to shun. It was a place they were to never have anything to do with because it was a place where they had built a false god, a god unto Baal. And to take such a sacred place and to turn it into something like that was something that was, well, what we're going to find is basically unforgivable. And here's what he says in verse 29. This is during the time of Jeroboam the first. All right, he was the king. Jeroboam the first was the king of northern Israel. At this time, keep in mind, Israel's divided. You have northern Israel, which is 10 tribes. You have southern Israel, which is Judah and Benjamin. Okay, so you have a division of Israel. And under Jeroboam the first and part of northern kingdom, he says, howbeit for the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who, that's bothering me, I'm sorry. I'm a little OCD about such things. Let me read that again. Howbeit, from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin, Jehu departed not from after them, to wit, listen to this, the golden calves that were in Bethel and that were in Dan. So you have two locations where they had set up the golden calves, and these were their primary locations. Now, that's significant in the fact that obviously these two places became really known for, these false gods that had been set up and had been the focus and the center point. And these two places became the places that agreed to have this take place. Now, Bethel is kind of interesting because when the land was first divided up, Bethel was actually in Benjamin. But Ephraim and Benjamin kind of had a little war, had a little battle going on over borders. And Ephraim expanded their border and took part of Benjamin and brought Bethel into Ephraim. So Bethel at this particular time is in Ephraim, a part of the northern kingdom. So in the northern kingdom, they had two places where they set up their false gods, and the primary locations were there in Dan and in Bethel, all right, which is Ephraim. Now, it's important that you understand Dan and Ephraim. Bethel was in Ephraim at this time. Because when you go back, we've talked about this a long time ago, but some of you might remember. But what we find is when you go back into Genesis and you begin looking at the 12 tribes of Israel when the land was divided and when those things were given and all of that was kind of set up, what you find are the 12 sons back there, it'd be ahead of us where we are in our text in chapter 49, but it talks about the 12 tribes. And in those 12 tribes, you have Dan listed. And remember, Joseph gets a separate portion. When they actually divide up the land and when they begin to divide up the people, Joseph gets a double blessing. And as a result of that, he has his sons Ephraim and Manasseh, who are considered each tribes because Joseph gets a double portion. And Levi is not mentioned because Levi is a tribe of priests, and they're scattered out among all the tribes. Okay, so actually the 12 tribes are the 12 tribes minus Levi. Joseph, having a double portion, makes him Ephraim and Manasseh. So in the Old Testament, when you're looking at the 12 tribes, that's what you get. Now, why is it when you get all the way over into Revelation and he starts talking about the 12 tribes, all of a sudden there's two tribes missing? The two tribes that are missing are Dan and Ephraim. And you might be scratching your head going, why isn't Dan and Ephraim mentioned in these? Instead, what they do is instead of Ephraim, it mentions Joseph. It just puts him back in his place, all right? And then he gets his second portion with Manasseh. And then the Levites are actually added back in, and Dan's removed. So Ephraim's removed, and Dan is removed. And if you're scratching your head going, why are they removed? It comes right back to this passage, where in Bethel, they had set up a golden calf. And in Dan, they had set up a golden calf. Now, that may seem like it's something irrelevant, but when you look through Scripture and you go back, I'm not going to list all of them, but if you look back, for example, in Deuteronomy chapter 29, it talks about Dan not being there, not being a part. In Judges, it talks about, you know, those that choose to depart from God will be eliminated, the tribes will be taken out. And what we find, in my opinion, it seems, because they took such a sacred place as Bethel and decided to remove God from that place and put these golden calves there, God didn't take that lightly. And those tribes were literally removed from Israel. So when you get over into Revelation, he doesn't care about Ephraim or Dan. They're not even listed as tribes. So it's just kind of interesting to me. Let me throw one more thought at you. It's kind of funny to me, but the Mormons teach that the Native Americans are the lost tribe of Ephraim, all right? Now, I'm not going to argue whether it is or isn't. I don't believe it is, but it doesn't matter, all right? The point is, why would you want to have kinship with a lost tribe because of their unbelief? Because they had chosen to establish a false god and were eliminated from the tribes. Who really cares? Why is that such a big deal to them that they are a part of Ephraim? I don't want to be. I don't want to be, you know, quite frankly. And so, you know, it's kind of interesting to me that they believe that America has this place because they believe that God has used Ephraim in America to build that up and to grow that up. So the Mormons put a lot of stock in that. But my whole issue is, if that's so, that would be detrimental. It wouldn't be positive. It wouldn't be good. It'd be bad. All right? So it's just kind of interesting to me that they've chosen to go that route. When I wouldn't want to go that route anyway. All right, now, so I said all that just to say that God expects us, if we are his people, to remain and be faithful. And God doesn't take lightly when his people choose to take a sacred site, even like our own selves, and cause it to be something that's detrimental to the cause of Christ. And so it's important. Even in the Old Testament, we see that picture. It is important that we hold true to the things that God has established. All right? So, let's go back to Genesis 37. Now that I've said all that. All right? Is that stuff you, I mean, some of you probably heard that before because you've heard me say it. Maybe you've heard other people say it. I don't know. But is that kind of interesting to you at all? Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So, you know, but it's a shame when you take a place that's such a great thing. You know, you see a lot of that in Scripture, by the way. Bethel is a good example of that. Do you remember the brazen serpent? You know, the brazen serpent, which was something God had given them. They looked to heal their wounds, and you know. But then later, they began to worship it, and God, it was called an idol. It became an idol to them, even though God had given it to them. Things like that can happen even today. If we're not very careful, you know, we take things even of God and turn them into an idol. If we're not very careful. I think people have done that with, say, like the cross, you know. The cross, you know, represents what Jesus Christ has done for us, and we get that. But there are people that have taken it to such an extreme that, you know, they feel like there's something to it and touching it or being, you know, and that it becomes something more than just, you know, what it is. And so it's just an emblem. It's a symbol, and don't ever let it become anything more than that. And a lot of people have done that with not only the cross, but with other things as well. We could do that, by the way, with church. You know, church is not the building, you know. And if we're not very careful, the building becomes church. And we lose sight of what God wants us to do. We got to be careful of all those things. But that's kind of the point that I want to make on this. All right, Genesis chapter 37. Verse 1. Just kind of opens the door to let us know where we're at and what's going on at the time. It says, Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger in the land of Canaan. So he just lets us know Jacob's now living in Canaan. And just for the record, the place where he's living is near Hebron. He's basically, if you're familiar with Israel today, how many of you know where the West Bank is? Do you know where the West Bank is? Okay. If you could just somehow or another picture this strip of land, with a Mediterranean Sea right here, and you got a strip of land right down here, and you got the Jordan River running down this side of it into the Dead Sea, all right? So imagine just a thin strip of land, about 71 miles from the Mediterranean Sea to Jordan River, all right? And we're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of about 260 miles top to bottom. That's all the bigger Israel is, by the way, all right? In fact, today it might even be less than that because the West Bank is Palestinian-controlled as well as the Gaza Strip. So it might even be less than that today, but nonetheless, somewhere in that area. So you've got this strip of land, and you've got the Mediterranean Sea on its coast, and then you've got the Jordan River on its other coast. The land that joins the Jordan River is called the West Bank. When you see on the news about the West Bank, it's talking about the land from the Jordan River almost to Jerusalem. Well, actually, it actually takes in a little bit of Jerusalem, all the way to Jerusalem, all right? So there's a portion of land there, and it runs about halfway down the Jordan River, all the way down just a little bit beyond the Dead Sea, all right? That's the West Bank. Hebron is in that lower portion of what's today is the West Bank, all right? So this land where he dwells is on, like, the southeast portion of Israel. All right, down near the Dead Sea. And that's where he's located. And so Israel's not that big, by the way. You guys know how big Israel is even today? I mean, how big it is? About the size of Vermont. Yeah, about the size of Vermont. If you can picture Vermont on the map, Vermont is our fifth smallest state. And Israel and Vermont are close to the same size. They're within like 500 square miles of being the same size. All right. So not very, you know, it's not very big. Total, if you're into that kind of thing, it doesn't mean anything to me, but about 8,000 square miles is how big it is. That don't mean anything to me. I can't. That doesn't even give me a register on how to figure it out. But for those of you that does, there you go. All right. Nonetheless, that's where they are. All right. He lives in Hebron. Now, the next verse or the next few, let me just jump into that. He tells us in verse 2, these are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock and his brethren, and the lad was the son of Bilhah and with the son of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Okay, this gives us a timeline in all of this, because up to this point, we really don't have a real timeline. You know, when he left Haran, to this point, it's hard to tell how many years it's taken him to get from Haran, which is up the very northern, beyond the northern border of Israel, down to the most southern border of Israel. How many years did it take him to travel that distance to deal with all the things they did? We know they stayed in Shechem for a little while. We know they camped. You know, he dug a well there, so he had to be there for a little while. But we lose sight of how long all of those things took place. Well, it tells us here that Joseph is 17 years old. So it gives us a real clear timeline. He was 6 years old when they left Haran. All right, so they've been gone for 11 years. So you've got about 11 years from the time they left Haran to get to where they are. Gives us a real clear timeline. We can now figure out, even by that, how old some of the other sons are and that kind of thing, and where they're at this particular time. Not only that, but living in Hebron and where they're located, there is a road that is a highly traveled road from Hebron to Shechem. We now, you know, come to know it as the Patriarch's Highway, because basically all the patriarchs that came down through that way came that road. That's just the road you take. And it kind of stops at Shechem, and at Shechem there's like crossroads there. So, you know, you can kind of go different directions once you hit Shechem. So from that point up to Shechem, it's just like a road, and you're going to travel that road. Now, there are other roads you can take that are more coastal. There's another road over there that actually is a part of Megiddo. But there's another road that if you were going to Egypt, for example, you would go that way and on down and around, go through Gaza and all that. But that's where they're at, all right? So they're at Hebron, which is the very southernmost part on this highly traveled road, all right? So this is where they're living. And what we find is Joseph now comes into the narrative. We really, this whole chapter is going to deal with Joseph rather than Jacob. And it's an interesting relationship that Jacob has with Joseph. Keep in mind, it's the oldest son of Rachel. And so obviously, you know, he really loves Joseph. Joseph is really special to him. And so he uses Joseph to do a few things that, you know, it's kind of interesting. Because he says that the guys were out doing some things, some of the brothers, and Joseph brings back an evil report. Now, we don't know if Joseph was just out there and saw them doing things they shouldn't do or made up some stuff, who knows. But whatever it was, he brought back to his father some tales, all right? This is what was going on, knowing it would displease Jacob. And whether or not Jacob sent him to spy on him or not, I don't really know. I can almost suppose that he does, because later we find out that when they go to Shechem, to graze their flocks, he does send Joseph up there to check on them, which makes you think the old Jacob's using Joseph as his little tattletale, all right? He's the guy that's going to check on the rest of the family, and he's the guy that's going to report back all the stuff that's going on. So he uses him in that way, it seems. And so that's what's going on. So he comes back and gives him an evil report, whatever it might be. We have no record of what that evil report is, but it doesn't really matter. It's something that Jacob wouldn't be happy about. But the biggest thing is it angers the brothers. And this really sets the stage for the events that are going to take place in the rest of the chapter. Because now we've got these siblings that are at odds with one another. So much so that, you know, they're willing to hurt him. All right. At this point, they're really angry with him and they don't like him. And so this is just a bad deal all the way around, and it's not doing Joseph any favors when you're looking at it. Verse 3, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was a son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. All right, let's just pull out all the punches here. Let's just throw it out on the table. Joseph was Jacob's absolute favorite, and he wasn't just his favorite behind closed doors. He made it pretty well known. Hey, guys, I know you all my children. He's my favorite. So much so, he says he made him a coat of many colors. Now, it's one of the best and most popular children's stories because, you know, the coat of many colors is so cool. But let me add to that what that really stands for, because this is something you probably didn't get in Sunday school. The coat of many colors wasn't given to him just because he liked him better. Keep in mind, this coat of many colors was a representation of the fact that he was going to bless him more than anyone else. What he was doing with this coat was letting everybody else know he's my favorite and he's going to receive the blessing. Now, how must this have felt to say like Reuben, who is the oldest, you know? Because basically what he was saying was, listen, I'm going to bypass the rest of you and I'm going to favor Joseph. You know, it'd be like if I were to make a will and let's say I've got 12 kids, 12 boys and then a bunch of girls, don't know how many. We know one, Dinah, but we know there's more. And what we also know is this, is then he gets up basically in front of them by giving him the coat and saying, just so everybody knows, I'm leaving my inheritance to him. How is everybody else going to feel about that? But that's what he was doing. That's what the coat represented. It represented that he was favored to the point that, listen, this guy is going to get my heritage. This is going to be the guy. He's going to get my greatest blessing. And so, you know, when you're looking at all these others that are much older than Joseph, and they're going, well, what about us? What about us? What about us? Well, I'm sorry, you weren't Rachel's son, you know. And so in his estimation, the wife that he loved, Rachel, this is the oldest son. And he was just making it very clear that he was his favorite and that he was going to be favored above all the rest. He did the same thing with Rachel, did he not? I mean, among all the women. So he made it very clear that that was a situation and that's what was going down. All right? So, you know, it's important that you see that because that sets the stage for everything else that takes place in this chapter. You know, all the brothers are looking at Joseph. Number one, we hate him because he's a tattletale. We hate him because Dad favors him. And we hate him because Dad has already established that he is going to have the heritage. He is going to get the blessing. That's what you're looking at. All right? So they're all hating him at this point. All right? Then you get into verse 4, and when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. They hated him to the point that they couldn't even carry on a peaceable conversation. They couldn't even stand and have a conversation with him. They didn't want him anywhere around them. They hated him that bad. All right? Hate him so bad, we don't even want to look at him. We don't want to see him. We don't have a conversation with him. He's done. Ichabod. All right? We're done with him. And that's the situation. Now, when you get in verses 5 through 10, it's kind of interesting. I'm not going to read these. You can read them while I talk if you like. But in verses 5 through 10, Jacob shares a couple of dreams that he has. And in both of these dreams, they were dreams that basically says, I had a dream that I was going to rule over you. That was what he told. Basically, the first dream was about his brothers, the rest of his family. And he said, listen, siblings, I'm going to rule over you. That was my dream. The second dream, I'm going to rule over you and I'm going to rule over my parents. All right? So in both of these dreams, he basically says, I had a dream that I'm going to rule over you. You guys are going to bow down to me. That's exactly what he's saying. You guys are going to at some point in time bow down to me. Now, that may sound really arrogant, but he was confident that these dreams were from God. And we know, because we know the rest of the story, that they are from God. But keep in mind, there might be some things you probably just ought not to say. You know, you've got brothers out there that already got a mind to kill you. And now you're going to gather them all together and say, hey, guys, I got to tell you this cool dream I had. You all are going to bow down to me one day. How's that going to go over? All right? But you see, that's the deal. That's exactly what takes place. And so he shares with them these dreams. Now, when he does so, what we find at first, of course, even as his father for the first time kind of turns on him a little bit, and it's like, seriously? You're saying I'm going to bow down to you? But who better understands dreams than Jacob? I mean, was it not Jacob, you know, that had the dream of the angels going up and down the ladder, you know? Was it not him who God revealed several things to him in a dream or visions or something of that nature on circumstances where it just says he talked with God, and we assume that's probably what took place? He probably knew dreams better than most people and understood that, you know what, if this is God, then so be it. And so we find that even though in verse 11 it just made his brothers more and more angry, his father had come to an understanding and had kind of accepted it, all right? So this is where we're at the end of verse 11. In verse 12, I lost my place. Verse 12, oh, I had turned page, I'm sorry. And his brethren went to feed their father's flock in Shechem, all right? So all the brothers said, okay, we got to go feed the flocks. And they took them to Shechem. Now, that doesn't sound like so much of a big deal. But I want you to stop and think about it for just a moment. Let's say, right here, we're feeding our flock, okay? And we decide we're going to go somewhere else and feed them because whatever reason. Maybe, you know, maybe we know that he's got a large flock because we also know they had to separate at some point, you know, with his dads and all that kind of stuff because they couldn't all dwell on the same land. So we know that wherever he's at, he's got really a large flock. We need to go somewhere else, probably because they need to let that land rest a little bit, let grass grow, do whatever they need to do. Go somewhere else and feed on and graze somewhere else. If I had a herd of or a flock of sheep here, all right, and I said I'm going to go somewhere else to graze, would it seem reasonable for me to herd them up and take them up to Dayton?
No.
You'd think I could just, yeah. Well, he went to Shechem, 50 miles away. 50 miles away. His brother said, hey, listen, we're going to take the sheep to graze somewhere else. And they took them 50 miles away, right? Took them from the road from Hebron to Shechem. It's just kind of interesting to me. Maybe it was just to get away from Joseph. And that's my suspicion. If we stay there, who knows what we might do? I got to get away from Joseph. I can't stand Joseph. We have got to get away. And they went 50 miles to get away, and I would assume to get away from Joseph. I can't imagine them having to go 50 miles away to feed their flocks. But they went 50 miles away. That's the distance from Hebron to Shechem. Yeah.
Well, he didn't tell them to bring in the report. They might have thought, see, if they go that far, he won't follow.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. Just to get away from Joseph. That's what I'm saying. They may have done this just for the purpose of saying, hey, I don't want to be anywhere near Joseph because who knows what he's going to say or do, and I don't want to see him anyway. You know, I hate him. And so, yeah, maybe to get away from him just so that he won't report back something that they're doing that's mischievous, but whatever the case may be, they went 50 miles away. Okay, so what we find out is they're 50 miles away, and not only are they 50 miles away, but if you stopped and thought about where they went, they went 50 miles away to where? Yes. Went to the land where you know people don't like you, who hate you because you killed, you know, the prince and all of his men. I mean, you've got bad relations with the people in Shechem. It's not a good place to be. Yet, they were so willing to get away from Joseph, they went 50 miles away to a place that hated him. All right? So it just interests me that when you look at this, this is where they're at, and this is where they went, all right? Then verses 13 through 17, Jacob sends Joseph out to Shechem. He says, hey, listen, go check on them guys. This is what leads me to believe that Joseph is kind of being played by his dad to some degree, too. You know, he's using him to kind of keep tabs on all the other guys. You know, he's favored. He don't have to do what they're doing. Why are they out watching sheep and he's not anyway? I mean, he's 17 years old. You think that's big enough, you know. Why are they out there with all the sheep and he don't have to? He's obviously favored. And he obviously doesn't have to do the same things they do. And it seems that dad's using him as a little bit of a spy on all the other guys. go to Shechem. See what they're up to. All right? So he sends him to Shechem. And he goes to Shechem to check on the brothers. He gets to Shechem. They're not there. He asks around. Somebody tells him, hey, listen, I ran into them. I know who they are. They're about 15 miles on up the road in Dothan. All right? So he goes another 15 miles up to Dothan. All right? And that's where he finds them. Now, that's not a good deal, because when he finds them, I'm farther up the road there in Dothan. Keep in mind that it's Shechem, where all the roads are kind of divided. This is where you can go back a different route. You can do something different. So, you know, Dothan, they just take one of the roads on up to Dothan. And there in Dothan, he finds them. And verses 18 through 27, you get this whole plot to kill him. All right? You guys have probably studied this before. You know enough about it. I'm just going to kind of not skip over, but I'm just going to kind of hit it. They kind of tease him. Here comes the dreamer. Here comes the dreamer. All right, they're going to mock him. And here he comes, and he comes up there, and they know who he is, and they suspect he's there probably to bring back another evil report and whatever the case may be. But they're a long way from dad. And they're thinking, you know what, we've got an opportunity here. Let's do this. Now, we understand and know the attitude of Simeon, and I think it was Levi, if I'm not mistaken, that was at Shechem, that did the dirty work at Shechem. And so we know they've got kind of a heart of mischief anyway. The guys that he brought an evil report back from are probably pretty riled up about him. The only ones that really don't seem to have, a bone to pick, or whatever you want to call it, an axe to grind, would be like Reuben, you know, maybe Judah. They're the only ones really kind of left out of that mix. And so what happens here is when the guys get together, they said, here's what we'll do. Let's kill him. We'll rub blood all over his coat, you know, his pretty little coat, and we'll take that back to dad and say, wild beast got him. All right? Pretty good plan if you want to get rid of him. Reuben's like, oh, whoa, let's not do that. Let's not get too hasty. Reuben's not up for killing him. Reuben says, I tell you what, let's just do this. Let's just throw him in a pit and just scare him to death, you know, just make him think that, you know, something's going to happen. We'll throw him in a pit. And we'll decide later what we're going to do. His intent was throw him in a pit, and he'd come back later, get him, and take him back to dad. That was Reuben's intent. But what happens is they throw him in the pit as though they're going to agree with Reuben. Reuben apparently doesn't say, but he apparently goes out and watches the sheep. It's his turn or something. And while they're all sitting around eating, they come up with this plan. Hey, listen, there's some Ishmaelites that are walking by. And there's some Midianite merchantmen that are walking by as well. And they said, why don't we sell him to the Midianites? To the Ishmaelites. Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. And everybody agreed that'd be a good idea. Then we could always bloody his coat and take it back. And that way we don't kill him, but we get rid of him. All right? Well, Reuben apparently is not in on this, because it says he comes back later to get him, and he's not in the pit. So he's kind of riled up about that, but now he's forced to go along with everybody else because the damage is done. The only thing that kind of is interesting with this is, there's some who say that there's a contradiction here, because you can't tell if they sold him to the Ishmaelites or the Midianites. And there are those who try to say, well, they sold him to the Midianites, who sold him to the Ishmaelites, who sold him to the Egyptians. What it really seems, and I think this is why we get the interpretation, says, he says the Ishmaelites were coming by, and he then says the Midianite merchantmen. Now, why did he call them merchantmen? You see, they were buyers and sellers. They were traders. The Midianites were the traders. So what it sounds like is the Ishmaelites, this was not something that was common among them. This was not something they would typically do. And it sounds like they kind of used the Midianites as the middlemen. You know, they kind of organized the sale. They kind of got it all together for them. Hey, well, listen, we're the merchantmen. We know how to settle. Let us help you with this. And they settled on 20 pieces of silver, but they sold them to the Ishmaelites. All right? But sounds like the Midianites are the ones that kind of organized the deal, kind of helped them with it. They were merchantmen. And that's why we mentioned, and it tells you what they are. They're not just Midianites. They're merchantmen. All right? By the way, just so you know who all these people are, you know who the Ishmaelites are, right? All right, the Ishmaelites are descendants of Ishmael. All right, pretty simple. Midianites are descendants of Midian, but do you know who Midian is? No, not the Midianites.
Wasn't that Abraham's brother?
Nope. Oh, I thought you was going to say it. It was actually another one of Abraham's sons by Keturah. All right. So it was the wife that came after Sarah. It was one of her children. All right. So both of these are Abraham's children. But the Midianites seem to have kind of played the deal for the Ishmaelites to buy him. All right. So long story short, they basically don't kill Joseph, but sell him to the Ishmaelites. And from there, basically, Reuben is an interesting one because you know Reuben, being the oldest, knew he'd be responsible for all of this. He was the one responsible. And so he knew he'd be the one who'd have to answer to Dad. And I think that's a lot of the reason, too, that he didn't want this all to go down because now it's going to look bad on him. He was supposed to be the one that would take care of him. And even though he's not, even if he got killed by wild animals, Reuben's kind of held in charge for that because he is the oldest and he should have been watching out for him. But nonetheless, this is what goes down. So they, in 31 through 33, they do all that, take it back to Jacob, 34, 35. Jacob could not be consoled. I mean, he was just wasn't able to be consoled. And by the way, we see in verses 34 through 35 that Dinah was not the only daughter. You see, it says all the daughters, okay, all the daughters, which also means it probably were more than two daughters. If there were only two, he'd probably said both the daughters. But he said all the daughters, which means there's likely at least three or more, all right? Nonetheless, so there's more than just Dinah. Just Dinah was mentioned because of her situation at Shechem, all right? But nonetheless, that's the situation. So Joseph was sold to Potiphar by the Ishmaelites, sold to Potiphar, the captain of the guards in Egypt, and that's where we'll pick up next week, all right? Any questions about any of that? Did you enjoy that tonight? Was that stuff that was... All right. Oh, by the way, some people say, and it's hard to just make this statement, but some people believe that Joseph in this particular incident was a type of Christ, although we never really see that in the New Testament, but a type of Christ in the sense that he was sold. They were saying that, you know, this whole concept about being thrown in a pit, that his brethren turned on him, and that he was sold, in this case, 20 pieces of silver, but he was sold away, and that and ultimately, even in the concept that he was portrayed as dead, you know, I don't know. You could play a lot of things into that, but I have a hard time tying into some of that, and the reason I do is because typically if there's a type in the Old Testament, you'll see in the New Testament somewhere that tells you it was a type. You got to be kind of careful not making things something that the Bible doesn't say, you know. So be a little bit careful, a little bit leery of doing some of that. There are types, and Joseph, there are some types of Joseph, by the way, and we'll see later. But this one's just debatable, all right? So, all right? Yeah, Raj.
So, was there a second brother?
There's 12 brothers.
Yeah. But at Shechem,
Simeon and Levi were the guys that did all the dirty work in Shechem. When they got together to eat, apparently Reuben wasn't there because it says he came back. But when they were sitting there eating and Judah came up with the idea, they all agreed to it. But Reuben says came back and the pit was empty. So he must not have been in on that. He must not have been in on that decision. He was out. So he must have been away. Yep. Yeah. He came back and the pit was empty. So he had to be gone somewhere. So he had to have left. Maybe just go watch the sheep or something. Doesn't say. But it doesn't say. Well, he knew he was going to come back to the pit because his intent was, let's throw him in the pit, and they did that, and then he must have left because his intent was to come back to the pit, get him out of the pit, and take him home. Well, when he came back to the pit, he wasn't there to get him out. Yeah. So now, yeah, now he's saddled with whatever everybody decided to do. He's kind of stuck with it. Well, the whole thing is, I mean, you know, I'm not going to begin to, there's a lot of ways you can look at that, you know, because they would have come to pass. If God had allowed him to be taken out of the pit, they still would have come to pass, just in a different way, because God said they'd come to pass. But that by that means, God used that means to make them come to pass. But had the story been different, I mean, I'm not going to question the providence of God at all, but had the story been different where Reuben rescued him, you know, at some point in time, it still would have worked out the same at the end. I just don't know how, because I wouldn't have the narrative for that. But I have to believe that whatever God said was going to happen is going to happen. But the way that it played out, that's the plan that apparently God chose, or God had in mind. So, you know, it's hard to know. There's a lot of things that, you know, I wonder sometimes, is this the way God intended for it to work? Or is God going to make it work no matter what, which we know to be the case? And if it doesn't work this way, he'll just use it another way. And there's no way for us to know. I mean, how much of it does he allow to be our choice, and how much does he, you know, is it just that he manipulates the situation? So it's hard to know. Well, no doubt. But I'm just saying, it could have happened anyway, and God would have still used it. Yeah, he still would have made it come to pass. And that's, you know, it's hard to make that sense of that, because that didn't happen, so it's neither here nor there. You know, it happened this way, and so that's the way it is. All right. You should have before you a copy of the minutes and